This is Jillian Barnard interviewing Riley Chatton. Is that correct? Okay. It is Friday, February 22nd. We are in Fintel Library. All right. Well, thank you so much for being here with us today. To start off, could you tell us a little bit about your childhood?
Oh, gosh. My childhood. Grew up in, I don't know. I grew up in Salem with my dad was a police officer. My mom was a hairdresser. Mm-hmm. And she went to school to be a nurse and have a sister and that is 4 years younger. Mm-hmm. Got a dog when I was in the second grade. And she was so beautiful. The only thing I could think to name her was Rose because I thought roses were so beautiful. But she also looked like a fluffy ball of fur, so her name was Fluffy. I lived there until I graduated, or shortly until I was lived there until 1991.
Gotcha.
I don't know how specific you want.
No, that's great. So then, after 1991, where'd you find yourself?
Anywhere but Salem. I still try not to come to Salem. I was grumbling about having to come here for this. I moved to Roanoke City. Well, initially I was homeless, so I was living with my then girlfriend in Vinton because she had moved back home with her family after trying to live on her own for a little while and enjoying partying too much. I think I'd broken up with someone. So then I've lived in Roanoke probably the rest of the time that I've since I left Salem. Mm-hmm.
And you said something just now that you were homeless for a little bit.
Yeah. So I came out to my parents as a homosexual, and my mom. My parents were divorced in November of 1990, and probably picking a couple of nights before her birthday was probably not the best idea, but you know, you don't have timing ideas when you're a teenager. And I was just a few weeks away from being 18, and so everything was ignored for a little bit until around the holidays. And then she didn't want me there on Christmas Eve, so I went and slept on my dad's sofa where my dad's wife lived because he was working in Richmond and was commuting back and forth at the time. And so I stayed there for a couple of nights and then went back home. And then I was there for, I returned back to our home in Salem, which is about a mile west of the high school, probably about 3 miles from here. And, you know, I don't know what the issue was, but one day my mom was in a snit and called the police and said, I don't want this garbage here anymore. And I was in my room at the time and I saw the blue lights in coming through the blinds. I was thinking, wow, she really called the police. And they were really nice. They said, you know, don't make this any harder than it needs to be. Just get something. And you know, maybe after things cool off, you can come back. Mm-hmm. I went back with a police escort to be able to get as much of my personal belongings as I could. But didn't go back.
So thereafter that, you talked about kind of what did you do after kind of that whole ordeal?
Well, that night I slept in the car because I didn't know where to go. That was before cell phones, so you had to old school dial. Right. And you woke up everybody if you called, you know. So I slept in the car and called my girlfriend the next day, and she had come out years earlier. And, oh, that was before transition. I guess I should reference I was living a life, female bodied at the time. I can recognize that it can be confusing for people. It's like, wait, what's with this guy? She had come out years earlier to her parents and had already gone through that whole, they'd work through it kind of thing. Okay. And so her mom was like, you know, come here. And so I stayed there for a couple of nights, then was able to get an apartment. And after a couple of nights, because it was a little wonky to, because I didn't really have credit. I had just turned 18. And so she had agreed to co-sign, which I was grateful for. Mm-hmm.
So then, kind of taking a step back for a second, during your childhood, youth, and growing up, so to speak, did you have any hobbies or any organizations or anything that really spoke to you during your developmental years?
Well, I was a Girl Scout for a number of years. My dad and I did all of the Girl Scout badges together. It was really kind of fun. Mm-hmm. I think there was only a few of them that we didn't do, and it was, they were things that we couldn't do in this area or couldn't do easily. It involved the ocean or something. You know, I can't remember what they were. Gosh, so many years ago. And so I did the Girl Scouts in 2 years. Probably should have paced that out. I think it's supposed to be 3 years. So I did the Girl Scouts. I really enjoyed the Scouts. And I played softball until I got to high school, and I played until the 10th grade, and I broke my collarbone. And I was a little skittish after that, at diving for a ball. So I guess I lost the nerve, because it was a freak accident, a really freak accident. I tripped over my glove.
Happens.
Yeah, it's one of those that I think back and I go, what was I doing, really? I did most sports in high school. I played basketball and volleyball, and I did indoor and outdoor track. And in the 10th grade year, I got most improved play. No, is an 11th grade year. I got most improved player for the track team. Well, when you break your collarbone and you only do a few meets, because I was playing softball, rec softball, and doing track. And so I got most improved my junior year and most valuable player in my senior year. And I thought I was going to go into the military, but that was about the time that they were doing the don't ask, don't tell thing. Mm-hmm. And I recognized it, my basketball coach was really, really, really thoughtful. And I didn't know then, because I came out to her years later, and she said, I know how you are, and you will not be able to keep your opinions to yourself. And and she said, so I would spend 2 years in community college so that you can go and go in as, you know, test in to be an officer. I think she was thinking, and you'll come out in the process. I didn't go into the military, though. I really thought in high school I was going to be career military to spend the rest of my life in there. And thankfully, I didn't, because I do have... If there's an injustice, I it's really hard for me. My brain will boil
if that's a good trait to have.
Yeah, if I'm biting my tongue and So it's probably a good thing I didn't go. Good advice there. I did end up going to Virginia Western, mm-hmm. and eventually went to Holland University, which is always really interesting now. Going for an interview in this area, because most people know it's a women's college. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've gotten a, so you went there for your undergraduate? Yep. And they don't really offer anything more. I go, yes, I did. How did that work? I just took classes there. And, you know, if they ask, I suppose, but we're in the South. People are more polite. And, yeah. So that's always interesting. I need to get a master's or something. That kind of trumps the other one. They noticed that one first. So, yeah, I guess that covers that part. Mm-hmm. So in the process, I came out and, did all that on my own.
Did you enjoy your time at Holland?
I did. Truly, it gave me a piece of paper. There's an Indigo Girls song called Closer Fine. I spent 4 years. Now I've got a piece of paper and I'm free. So it gave me a piece of paper that says that I can get an education. That really is all that it says. And because I don't use it. I had wanted to be a teacher, and I was doing my teacher internship. And it was the same year, again, the injustice, the same year that they were starting to implement the punishment for not passing the SOLs. Well, before they had the SOLs, and this was the first year that they were implementing the punishment. And there was a student that had failed. Apparently, it's changed a little bit since then. And, you know, this is where I think people listening to what the struggles are with people. And so there was a student in the class where I was doing this semester-long internship who was, I think, like the salutatorian of their high school. I think that's what it's like, the second in line. Mm-hmm. Had been accepted to Duke for pre-med, was going that summer to do this like crash course of a bunch of classes, and they didn't pass their English SOL, so he had to go to summer school. And I remember the student coming in and going, my whole life is ruined. And they won't let me retake it. I think now you can test out of it. And you just have to pay for the summer class, but you can test out of it again. And I remember going, hell, if I want to be a part of this, like, this just ruined this child's life. This isn't what I thought being a teacher was. So I didn't finish that. Had I had a really affirming advisor, they would say, this is how you do this, you know, but they didn't.
The punishment for not passing the SOL was summer school?
At the time, yeah. Well, they had to go to a special intensive thing for the SOLs. And at the end of it, you retake the SOL. And if you don't pass, I don't know. I guess you have to repeat the whole thing again. I don't know.
Wow.
But I just remember that one part and just going, no. I can't do that.
Because I grew up with SOLs too.
I'm from
Virginia. So when someone wouldn't pass in high school, I think you took it again a week later.
Mm.
Like your intelligence, your knowledge of the subject would magically grow in a week. But
well, anybody can have an off day.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I think they've changed it, because I've talked to people and I've gone, oh, that must have changed it. But I think this was the first year, and I remember that student. I often wonder what happened to them.
Yeah.
And yeah. What, did anybody get their head out of their butt and help this kid get to school? You know? Anyhow.
So then post-Holland, where are you at?
Well, I was a good feminist that Holland's nurtured. So Holland's did give me a piece of paper, but more it gave me more of a sense of awareness of the world. I was older, so I wasn't finding myself. I'd already found myself where most people, like you all, are probably, what, 20, 21? Mm-hmm. Usually you're going, okay, I'm learning how to live on my own. I'm learning how to take care of myself. I'd already figured that out. So when I was there, I was really in the trenches going, who am I? Who do I want to be in the world? And which is what you'll probably start doing by the time you're 25. And so I got to do that in a scholarly setting and learning about the world at the same time and how I fit in the world. And so when I left, I was still processing all of that. And at the same time, while I was one of the internships I had, I came under the understanding of two-spirit people. Because I had done an internship with the Gay, Lesbian, Straight Education Network as part of the, because I thought I was going to be a teacher and, you know, I want to be a part, I want to be an affirming ally as a LGBT person. So I left there and I went and worked at Planned Parenthood for about 2.5 years. And in that time, we bought the LGBT bookstore from the two people who owned it before. Mm-hmm. And so we bought that. And in the meantime, I started questioning everything. And it was like nothing was making sense. You know, my spirituality, because I had left the church when I was a teenager. And because when I was in my early teens, we were watching MASH, and they had Father Mulcahy, and I loved how he would change from the stole to the yarmulke, but he was still wearing the tab collar, but he met each person where they were. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't know how many people noticed that, but there's something about that that spoke to me. That and the music band. I really appreciate how he met each person and gave them, helped them find their gift. So those two parallels really spoke to me. And I said, I want to be a chaplain. My mom goes, you're not Roman Catholic. And then she goes, and you're not a man. Well, I proved her wrong. And people call me today a recovering Roman Catholic. But I'm not an Episcopalian. But... So I became a practicing Buddhist around that time. And yeah. And so I was about 30 years old, became a practicing Buddhist shortly before we closed the store, and became a holistic practitioner. And it was probably during that time that I really started recognizing issues with my gender. And my dad became ill and died in 2010, but he became ill in 2008. And I had gone back to school, taking a semester at Hollins and working on the Masters in Arts and Liberal Studies. And so when my dad became sick, I had a private practice, and so I had the most flexible schedule, so I was taking him to appointments and stuff. And ended up dying in 2010. Smattering through there, I probably worked a couple of different jobs, just never really feeling a connection. I wasn't teaching. I wasn't, never before I did the holistic healing practice. And I've worked on both sides of HIV testing and counseling and care also, because I was a registration representative with the clinic who treated the infectious disease. So I've seen both sides of, you know, let me talk to you about prevention and talk to you about your test results and what you do from that, and to see what happened after that. So I've seen all sides of the disease. And I remember someone that I talked to came into the clinic and that I'd done testing on for years, and I go, I know I talked to you. Were you not listening? And they said, yeah, I was. And, you know, it's one of those things that just takes one slip of judgment. It's like, I have a really good friend who said, I was having a really good time and I didn't want to stop it. And that one time, and they live with HIV for the rest of their life. Mm-hmm. That's a whole different conversation. Yeah.
So it sounds like you dabbled in a little bit of everything.
I have. And I think that's one of the things that, where I am now as a spiritual director, and I finally started studying to be a chaplain, I go, you know, I want something more long-term than these little... here's your Band-Aid, It was during that time that I started recognizing, but this could go further than this, and they leave the hospital. So spiritual direction is one of those things that I appreciate mm-hmm. more. It's more, it's like a chaplain that you go see on a more long-term basis.
Could you talk a little bit more about the bookstore that you owned and operated?
Sure. It was started many years before. I can't remember how long it had been in existence, probably 92, 93. And we took occupancy of it in 2002 and had it until 2004. The two men who owned it, they were moving out of state. And having grown up here, I recognized the importance of having the bookstore and the importance that of it being a central hub. That was before the Roanoke Diversity Center was here. And MCC was here, and we worked a lot with MCC. But having grown up here and going to Outright, it was Outright then, having gone to Outright, I recognized the value because the bookstore that where I got the book called Invisible Lives, which talked about lesbian, mostly lesbian existence, and it was the first book where it was the first time I had ever read. I was like, oh my God, there's other people like me, and but there's this one little section in this bookstore, and the bookstore since closed. It's now a restaurant. I look, it's like such a pity. Such a great bookstore. Mm-hmm. But that was at the beginning of the internet, and you could get everything on the internet. And in Roanoke, we're still a very closeted community. Even in 2018, that was in 2002 to 2004. And so it was really easy to get stuff on the internet and just have it shipped to your home. And most things said in private, not rainbow colored, this is your queer package coming to your door kind of thing. And people like that subtlety, that privacy. And so I think that we were struggling with keeping up with the internet and having a store. During that time, we brought in a lot of authors for book signing. We had Rita Mae Brown, Lambda Literary Award winner Alex Sanchez came twice. Several others that came, but you know, I think everybody knows Rita Mae Brown, and especially with the Sneaky Pie series. But so we tried to create an environment that was more of a hub, and where you could come and find out, you know, where there was, because it's hard to, when the only thing that you know is a bar, to know that there's other things out there, and that not everybody is comfortable with going to a bar, especially if people that are in recovery, and that there needs to be other options. So when we took over the store, shortly thereafter, they were building the now empty Roanoke Times building to upgrade the newspaper processing. And during that time, there was a weird rain that came that dropped 4 to 6 inches in a matter of a half an hour. And I had gone home and was getting something at home. My wife was at work, and well, my partner then, it was before we legally married. We had had a holy union though. And I called her and said, I'm on my way. Pack up what you can and lift up what you can. And she said, no, we'll be fine. And by the time I got there, she said, no, we're fine. It's still in the road. By the time I had gotten there, I was walking in ankle-deep water, and she had flipped the breaker, and we got cash. And I wasn't there for, gosh, just a couple of minutes. And we left the store with 4 inches of water in it and walked out into knee-deep water. And we ended up having to walk home because in that process our car got flooded. And literally, I had parked the car, and that's how fast that rain was rising. And we were on the front page of the newspaper. It's kind of funny. It was really dramatic. She had taken off her glasses, and I was holding her hand because she said, I can't see. It's raining so hard. It was just, you know, muddled. So I was holding her hand. We were trying to walk across the road, and I was talking to her over the curb. So the picture looks really dramatic, and it really isn't. It was our classic life of, what's that? Like, I can see anything. So it looks really dramatic on the picture, but, you know, it's really not. And it's like, well, there's this huge mat, and it ended up being all the mats in several of the restaurants had lifted up and floated off. So you had these huge black rubber mats floating down the road, floating down the road, because it was, we walked across the road with in knee deep water and walked home. And I would say that was the beginning of the end. We never really recovered from that, along with the internet coming along. And it was becoming more popular. Barnes & Noble had an ever-increasing LGBT section. And, you know, that's one of those things that, you know, there's positives and negatives to becoming more socially diverse and accepted. And, you know, we lose things that are hubs. Mm-hmm. I think, unfortunately, one of the things that we could probably do more of is try to figure out how to retain that in the process, but how to, you know, hold on to the inclusivity within the diversity.
So you said that was kind of the beginning of the end of the bookstore.
Yeah, we only had possession of it for, it was just over 2 years. We closed it in March of 2004, and we had taken occupancy of it in February of 2002. And I think also the idea that during that time we replaced the front window 3 times because people would throw bricks through it. It was also during that time when, I can't remember who was doing it, but some church had these videos of the life of Jesus. And you could send it to someone that you felt you needed to get the message to. We received an astronomical amount of Jesus videos, let me tell you. And DVDs, when DVDs came out. it's really sad. You know, they could use that. You know, I understand people believing in something, but, you know, no one likes things being forced on them. And I wish people would recognize that. That's not love. That's not the action of God. But that's a whole different conversation. So that was the beginning of the end. It was also the beginning of the internet. And, you know, there's something about being able to hold your privacy and not go into an LGBT bookstore. Because around the time that I came out, there was also this huge sting operation that happened, and there were 17 gay men that were arrested for soliciting sex. It wasn't for payment, but they were still arrested, one of which was a teacher in my high school, and there was another teacher that was part of those. It ended up being 17 that were convicted, but I think 22 had been arrested. But the other ones, I think, were of questionable, you know, whether or not it was more forceful or whatever it was. And that was between the two parks of Highland Park and Wysena Park. Wysena Park is now not drive-through, and I think that's one of the reasons why it's now just a greenway. So there's still a lot of privacy that Roanoke has. And in some ways we've created a closet in that way, because we've removed that hub.
Yeah, that was something I was going to ask. Operating the store that is designed to be the hub in a very closeted environment, regional space, do you think that impacted the number of visitors that you received?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Because we would have people that would come in during the day, and because a lot of people were closeted, and it was really awkward when we would see people that would come in with their boyfriends or girlfriends during the day, and we would see them later with their married spouses of opposite sex. And we saw that probably more than people would realize. And so there was also that element of privacy that we had to keep that, you know, oh, how such and such. And you know, I had started a thing when I was with Outright of whenever I saw, whenever anyone came to a group, we said everything that says here is said here is private. And if you see me in public, you have to say hi to me first, because it's easier for me to explain who you are than me to explain who the adult, for you to explain that I'm an, how do you know this adult? And, you know, I don't know who they're with, but, you know, most people know how I am. So that's how we operated in general. So we didn't really say hi to anyone unless someone said hi to us, which is partially lonely in an LGBT community, because you start isolating yourself.
Right.
Because you start knowing the secrets.
Mm-hmm. Fine line between being respectful but also wanting to be a community.
Yeah.
Could you expand a little bit more on your time with Outright?
Sure. So I became the coordinator of Outright in spring of 2000, and was there until December of 2005, I believe. Might have been 2006. I'm trying to think. It was 2005, and during that time, we had the Backstreet shooting, and so the processes of listening to young adults think, this could be me in a number of years, and to recognize the importance of having something other than bars to go to. And because that was the only thing that we had for a number of years, we had three different bars. And I remember when I came out, oh, this is the bar that you go to if this is how you behave. This is the bar that you go to if this is who you are. And this is this bar that you go to if this is how you are. And this is how you came out. I'm going, well, I don't really fit any of those. And so there's nothing else. And, you know, once you became an adult, and you were, I think Outright then was 21, you had nothing. And so Outright, the way we operated, the way I took it into the direction of creating more awareness of things in the community. And each year we had job day, career day, and we had people that were openly LGBT in some way come and talk to the people there and say, this is who I am. This is who I am in the community. This is the job that I have. And talk about their experience of coming out. Are they out in their work? And you know, not all of them were. And you know, there are some people that were really, really visible in the LGBT community that were not out at work. And if you saw them out in public, they will not acknowledge you, even to this day. And which is interesting. And so in hearing their experiences and share their experiences and try to help to educate, to be aware that of the otherness out there. Mm-hmm. And that there's different ways to live your life, where I think right now we're still pigeonholed in the LGBT community, and that, you know, people lose the idea of who they are, and that we've become almost homogenous in some ways, and that, you know, we're either this or we're either that, and we're not hopefully diverse. As I remember growing up, the diversity and the awareness.
Oh, sorry, I'm just keeping time.
And so, I think that is one of those things that we tried to focus on. Because I worked at Planned Parenthood, I was really adamant, and I did HIV testing and counseling. I was one of the first ones to do the oral test, and to be trained in that in Roanoke, one of the first three. And because of that, I said, look, this is a risk. And, you know, we did have safe sex. People come in and talk about safe sex. And, you know, a lot of people would take issue with that. And, you know, it was really interesting. It was a really conservative Christian person at the rescue mission that said, we don't all approach sex awareness in the same way. And we all assume that everyone's parents are going to be able to have that conversation. And, you know, sometimes you have to be able to have that conversation. And if your parents are thinking that you're just abstinent and you're not, then it's a risk. So I really appreciated their conversation. And, because we had a condom tasting. It's like, that you still have a risk with oral sex. And so, you know, good to know what flavor you like. And so, you know, we made it playful and made it okay to use condoms and wanted to make it fun. You know, now they have all kinds of fun colors and designs and the ribbing and... they've come a long, long way from the plain ones. And I remember they had ones that came out like that were the colors of the bomb pop. And that was a big deal when that came out. I think those were the first ones that were colored that weren't the flavored ones. And you know, we also had dental dams. It was really funny because when I started dating my partner, she would go and get stuff out of it. She's like, oh, yeah, my socks are there. She said, you had the most condoms and dental dams of anybody I've ever known. I said, well, you know, it's not that I'm using them. It's that I always have them on hand and take them to group meetings whenever I was around Planned Parenthood or the drop-in. It was before the drop-in center was around, so it was at the Council of Community Services. So I always like to make sure I have condoms on hand for meetings and stuff. So while I was at Outright increased tenfold, and we had three meetings a month on Thursdays. We had one that was for allies, and the other ones were just for the LGBT youth, because it's good to know that you have allies, but it's also good to be able to talk about those things that you can talk about with people that understand what you're going through. So we started a journal group, and we had just a casual meeting. We'd show a movie once a month or every other month, something like that. And then, it was a lot of fun. Usually we'd show a movie every now and then for the allies. And a lot of the youth I still talk to, when I came out as transgender, one of the youth said, you were so helpful to me. I'm here for you. I know I'm not transgender, but I'll be your ally. At which I thought was really, really thoughtful. And that was when she shared with me, you know, you don't realize what little things that you give people. She said, you were very forward that day, but what you told me helped me. And she said, so that's why I feel really, you know, I'm here for you. She said, you looked at me and said, wow, you're a triple minority. As soon as you recognize that and that you're going to have those obstacles, then you're not going to be shocked when they happen. Because she was a black lesbian. And She said, no one had ever told me that. And she said that probably kept me from being a bitter old woman.
Wow. So you spoke to a little bit about your coming out process. Mm-hmm. Could you share, if you're comfortable, about coming out as transgender?
You know, it was a process. And I, when I was at GLSEN, I learned about Two-Spirit. And so when I met my partner, Go, I am a Two-Spirit person. And at that point, I took it to mean an androgynous person that occupies two spirits, that I have a masculine side and I have a feminine side. And also at the time, I was talking to Patricia Warren, who just died, and she had said, you have to get an alligator hide. And I took that to mean that you just ignored that. And unfortunately, I had... Right around the time she died, I literally was thinking, I need to email her and say, I understood what you were saying. It took me a little while, 10 years, but, you know. She said, okay, my partner said, great, Two-Spirit. And as I got older and started, you know, learning more and started recognizing that I didn't see myself the way other people see me. And I had been doing triathlons and doing open water swimming and stuff. And I noticed I was reading magazines and fitness magazines. I was always reading the article about the men, which are usually more, this says a lot about our community. The women's were always about looking fashionable and nice. And the men's were, this is how you become stronger. Excuse me, I think that says something more about our society than, you know. But one day over breakfast, I look at my partner and I go, do you ever forget when you're running or riding your bike that you have a female body? And she said, no. I think that might be a problem. Yeah, so, you know, in my head I'm going, okay. There's something with that. and, you know, when I was, because I was active in PFLAG and there was an openly transgender woman there, openly shared her story. I remember her story of, she's like, women talk, you guys are chatty in the bathroom. She's like, I didn't know, hand reached under, I need some toilet paper. Okay, honey. I'm hearing her story. So I remember that when I came out. Don't talk. Hey, how you doing? Not that people really ever talked to me because I was always really androgynous. I had the reactions going into the bathroom were horrible. So about that time I started going, I had seen a documentary on gender called Genderqueer, I think is what it was. Okay, well, I'm genderqueer. And I thought, I'm going to focus on not recognizing my gender. And I was very noticeably female. And I had a really high voice. And so every time I spoke, even from when I was a kid, I would say, whose voice is that? Because that was not the voice I heard in my head. So I never felt that I was trapped in my body. It never made sense. And one day I was working a temp job, because it was right after we had closed the store. I was looking for a job. And it was right before I started doing the holistic practice. And I was working this temp job and I was listening to a podcast and it was on transgender people and they referenced, and transgender people, it's not that they feel trapped in their bodies. They have an identity of a male body. And I go, oh shit. And I think I was filing and I think I audibly said that. I was also listening to one that had a ghost story and I jumped when someone walked past the filing room. It was really kind of funny. But so it was about that time that I started recognizing that. And I was doing a lot of swimming. And I was a practicing Buddhist at the time. And I did, my swim coach said, I'm going to do a challenge you to, this was about the time Diana Nyad was swimming from Key West to Florida. And I was following that. And I was really inspired by that because I wanted to do long distance swims and in open water. And she said, I challenge you to swim 3 miles for the 3 days that she's out there in the ocean every day, which was the distance. It would be 110 or 111 laps was the miles that she was, that she was swimming, which equaled 3 miles for me in a pool. So I did that 3 days in a row. I was so sore that third day. But that is when I recognized, it's when you leave your mind. It was the time that I understood the Buddhist practice of sitting on a meditation cushion and of letting go of your thought, because your physical body, the only thing that you can do is, I had a conscious decision, I had to push off that wall each time. But because your mind is so tired, all of those thoughts that are buried deep inside come up. And in that process, it came out, you know, will you ever know what it feels like to be a man in the world? And I left the water that day and I became really depressed. And contemplated suicide, had a plan. Weird course of things. I also ended up with a B12 deficiency, which made me look like I had cerebral palsy, Parkinson's, sorry, for a day, and prevented that. And I go, okay, well, I'm here. And I was getting a tattoo of a joy Buddha with swim goggles. And I said, if I make it to get that tattoo, then I will forever remove suicide as an option, and I have to decide how to live my life. And I did, and obviously. And the very next day, I fell out of the lifeguard stand and I twisted my knee. So I had the tattoo. I couldn't end my life. I had made that promise. And my promises are pretty serious. And I remember sitting there and crying and going, what the hell, God? Fuck you. Excuse my language. But I was mad. I remember sitting there and crying. And I had bought a book and I thought, well, I'll sit and read this book. It was The Dharma Punks by Noah Levine. And in that, he talked about doing a year to live. So that December 21st in 2011, I started the year to live. And there was a meditation that January where I go, okay, how will I feel if I lose my hair? It's just my hair. Can I take care of myself if I lose my sight? And it was a meditation, one of the meditations that you go through. And I remember looking in the mirror, if you were dying in a year, what would you regret? And it was not knowing what it feels like to be a man in the world. And I go, who said that? Called my counselor and said, I think we need to talk. And he said, well, the toothpaste is out of the tube. What do you do with it? The ball's rolling. So about a month later, I came out to my partner. We had been together for a little over 11 years at the time. And it probably took us about 8 months to figure out how we were going to be a couple in the world, how, you know, what the importance of that is. And she is an amazing person. And I can't be the person I am today without her, I don't think. And she said that she asked herself a question of, would my life be better without me in her life? She said, no. And so we spent probably a year figuring out how our life was with me being male and coming out to our friends, who most of them we aren't friends with. You really find out who your real friends are when you come out and you say, I have leprosy, so to speak, you know, and, you know, how close are, you know, who's your close friends? So, that was my process of coming out, and came out slowly. We joked and said we had weekends with Riley, and I was working a job as a lifeguard. I was in a swimsuit, and you're not hiding a whole lot then. I stopped shaving my legs, which was horrible. From the day I began, it was just not natural. I can't tell you how many times I've shaved like whole sections of my leg off when I was a teenager. I mean, just gashes. Like, that didn't come natural. Shaving my face, never once. It's like, it just kind of shows you. It's like, come on, Mom. You know it. It's like when I came out to my mom, she went to her best friend, torn up, and said, and her best friend said, you're surprised? My mom, God bless her, didn't find any allies. Everybody was like, come on. It's like stereotypical. I drove a truck. I mean, listen, if there was a stereotype, I had it. So.
Well, thank you for sharing.
Yeah.
So now you are, you're a spiritual director.
I am, yes.
Right?
Yeah.
It seems like that's kind of been a theme throughout your life, throughout our conversation. Can you talk a little bit about your work right now and what you do?
I'm a spiritual director, and because of two bouts of being homeless, the second time I was literally homeless for 2 weeks, and I didn't look for a home at that time, and I couch surfed, slept in my car, which is now illegal in Roanoke County, the absurdity of it, because I was going to go to New York City to do the internship, and I used that time to really delve into myself and to find who I am. And I think that was when that seed got planted of being a two-spirit person. As a spiritual director, I serve at the rescue mission. I volunteer there one day a week. I am not openly transgender there. If they have someone that is LGBT, they usually say, you'll really connect with Riley. They usually send me to the LGBT people. And because we live different lives than most people. As a spiritual director, I've found a real connection to saints because most of them were outcasts in their community. They weren't understood because they were talking in a way that most people didn't. Even Jesus was an outcast in his community. And so I've found community that way. And as a spiritual director, it's more of I take it from a place of empowerment and help people to find their own spiritual path. I have Christian and Buddhist practices, but since I've studied Jewish mysticism with the Kabbalah, I've studied under a shaman, I've dabbled in a whole bunch of different things. So I'm trans in a lot of different areas, not only in gender, but in spirituality, and I'm partly Episcopalian, partly Buddhist, and partly Roman Catholic, and sometimes I'm very male identified, sometimes it's like, because even before transition, I didn't talk with my hands. I don't know what this is. They don't sit still now. I have jazz hands. So, you know, but I also don't feel male or female. Which is a really, I know I recognize I have a beard, but I go through life recognizing that people see me as male, but I know how everybody lives differently. Mm-hmm. And you two might be in the same class, but you're going to, if you really sit down and you talk about it, you're going to have two different perspectives. And how many people in your class, you all have different filters and different experiences coming into the class. So you're going to process it all completely different. And so that's really how it takes spiritual direction of who are you? How did you grow up? And how can we help you to feel more full?
That's like related to something Dr. Rosenthal said one day. I think it was intersubjectivity, that we all bring our own perspectives and ideas and everything. So our interpretations are therefore different from one another. Wrapping up a little bit, what advice would you give to someone who is thinking about transitioning or wanting to begin that?
Someone who's contemplating transition, to find a person that is a confidant, at least one person that they feel is solid, because that person might be the only person at the end of it. Transition is like playing cards, and you have to be willing to put them all on the table. And if you're lucky enough, you get to pick some of them up.
So then also, what qualities or what characteristics do you think makes the most ideal ally?
Someone that accepts you as where you are and listens with empathy and recognizes that we all approach transition in different ways, and we ask different things of our bodies. You know, whether I know people who are trans identified and don't wish to have any surgeries and don't wish to take any hormones, and said, but this is who I am, you know, honor who I am. So an ally would meet that person there, because also not everybody's able to have surgeries or begin hormones for health reasons. But an ally meets you where you are as best they can.
Makes a lot of sense. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we wrap up?
I want to be respectful of your time. I was already fashionably late.
We don't have anything today.
Oh, good, good.
Well, with that, I think we can conclude.
Okay. If you have any other questions, feel free to ask. If, you know, you're listening to it, you go, what did he mean?
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes, definitely. We will. Thank you so much.